Now, both Christianity and the Bible are under attack in these last days and in ways we could never have imagined just a generation ago. One recent example is the case of Mr. Dan Cathy, CEO of the Chick-fil-A restaurant chain. Cathy, a devout and very public Christian, defended the biblical traditional view of marriage in an interview with the Baptist Press. Not once did he say anything negative about gay people. He simply spoke out in support, in a positive way, of traditional biblical marriage. Here's what he did say. I think we're inviting God's judgment on our nation when we shake our fist at him and say, we know better than you as to what constitutes a marriage, and I pray God's mercy on our generation that has such a prideful, arrogant attitude to think that we have the audacity to define what marriage is about. The mainstream media and political left and liberal establishment in general went ballistic. His comments were loudly labeled hate speech. That's right. Supporting traditional marriage as it is in the Bible is now considered hate speech. Mayors of cities like San Francisco, Boston, and Chicago gave great swelling speeches lecturing Dan Cathy on inclusion and tolerance. Then they announced that because Dan Cathy was exclusive and intolerant, they would not tolerate Chick-fil-A's inclusion in their business communities. It was stunning. City officials discriminating against a legal business selling a legal product, all because certain government officials didn't like the personal opinion of the business owner. It was almost comically ironic. I could almost hear them saying, we, the truly tolerant, cannot tolerate intolerance, and so we must exclude Chick-fil-A in the name of inclusiveness, because nothing is more intolerant than not sharing our opinion. These are the voices that claim to be the voices of reason. In reality, what Dan Cathy believes is what they claim is unreasonable, and that is that there is a personal God to whom we are all accountable, and he has revealed himself in the Bible. The Apostle Peter wrote about the coming day of the Lord in his second letter. Know this first of all, that in the last days mockers will come with their mocking, following after their own lusts. You know, that is a dead-on description of Chick-fil-A story. On Wednesday of last week, supporters of Mr. Cathy and his restaurant chain, which, by the way, has more than 1,600 franchises and employs more than 50,000 people, held a Chick-fil-A Appreciation Day. Literally, millions of Americans stood in long lines, sometimes for hours, just to buy a chicken sandwich and show their support for the restaurant chain. If the national mainstream media took notice at all, it was to mock them. Supporters of alternative marriage promised to hold counter-demonstrations in which gay people would picket the restaurants and hold kiss-ins. The same media that gave sparse notice to millions in support of Dan Cathy, and by extension, traditional marriage, gave maximum coverage to the few activists who did show up for the counter-demonstrations. The Apostle Peter said that the mockers would eventually turn to mocking the Bible and its promises, saying, where is the promise of his coming? Ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continued just as it was from the beginning of creation. To the mocker, the Bible is a book of myths and stories, and believers are superstitious bigots. But the best scientific arguments against God are, as we saw in our last broadcast, the best arguments in favor of God and the truth of the Scriptures. Before moving on, let's consider some of the ramifications of the philosophical position that there is no God. This is generally what the skeptic, agnostic, and atheist believe. Our world, with all its resources, intricate complexities, exact timing of planetary and galactic orbits, and orderliness, come about with no intelligent impetus, cause, or source. they believe that everything just happened out of time plus chance. The laws that govern our universe have developed without guidance or direction. Great magical leaps happened along the evolutionary way, allowing non-plants to cross the chasm to become plants, and non-animals to become animals, invertebrates to become vertebrates. Without guidance or cause, primordial ooze developed brains where non-brains had been, and sensory organs were nothing like them had been. Randomness accounts for the delicate, unique composition of our planet that makes possible our existence on this oasis of life in the vastness of a hostile universe. A universe in which travel from one galaxy to another is impossible. The skeptic believes man is without a spirit. His existence ends at death, just as it does for dogs and cats, and morality that man possesses is instilled by evolving social structure. The Bible, a book that was written by 40 diverse men who lived over a span of 1,500 years, kept separate records, recorded events independently, and yet told a remarkably single story. Just an incredible coincidence. There is no master plan for mankind, they think. Our existence is an accident. Our work on earth is fruitless, and our relationships with one another are ultimately meaningless. They believe we have no other purpose on earth but survival. Christ was not telling the truth, they believe, when he said he was the Son of God who came from heaven to rescue us from eternal death and bring us to God. And neither were the 12 apostles, all of whom suffered loss of family, friends, community, and ultimately martyrs' deaths for the witness of Jesus. The challenge facing the skeptic is that his judgment of God is rendered according to his own limited understanding. It's sort of like a minuscule flea issuing the solemn evaluation that because he can't see the whole of him, there is no dog. Clearly, the flea is something of a fool, since the evidence that the dog exists is everywhere around him. The thick hair that shelters him grows from the dog. The food that he eats is the dog. Without the dog, he would surely die. Dog is everywhere in the universe, but the flea can only see his teeny piece of it. And from his limited teeny perspective, he cannot discern the full being of the dog. He therefore believes that there must be no dog. But whether or not the dog really exists is not dependent on the flea's opinion. As they say, facts is facts. Believe them or not, explaining the universe without God requires ignoring the evidence from creation. On our last broadcast, we saw how the Higgs boson, or God particle, is responsible for giving mass and weight to otherwise invisible particles. The discovery rocked the scientific world, but in reality, the discovery of the Higgs boson is just another breaking news story from the first century. The headline was written first by the Apostle Paul in the book of Romans. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. Paul says that the invisible things, or forces, are clearly seen and understood by what those same forces make visible to the eye. Precisely what the scientist of CERN confirmed last July 4th, and he stated this even before telescopes, microscopes, particle colliders, scientists, and theories. Paul's position is that in creation, it is so obvious that man has no excuse for denial. The science in the scriptures is therefore nothing short of amazing. It wasn't until the early 20th century that science confirmed Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. The earth had a beginning. It wasn't until this generation that science concluded that time also has both a beginning and an end, something the Bible revealed centuries ago. The Bible explains this in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 9, and Titus chapter 1, verse 2. World-famous cosmologist Stephen Hawking agreed, making this remarkable statement. All the evidence seems to indicate that the universe has not existed forever, but that it had a beginning about 15 billion years ago. This is probably the most remarkable discovery of modern cosmology. Yet, it is now taken for granted. The book of Job is generally the first place Christians turn when they want to see how best to stand up to the trials and tribulations of life. But the book of Job is much more than a narrative about patience and reward. The book of Job is rich with evidence of God's truth. In it, God reveals much about science, nature, physics, astronomy, and geography. Details that no single person living in those ancient times could possibly have known. Especially not someone living in the Middle Eastern desert. For centuries, man believed that the earth was flat. But 2,800 years ago, Isaiah said the earth is round when he wrote, "He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in." The word circle in the Hebrew can also mean sphere, which means even more. This not only revealed that the earth is a circle, not flat, but also said that God spreads out the heavens for man to live in. You see, in the Bible, heaven can mean one of three places. It can mean the place where God lives, or the galaxies with their stars, or the atmosphere that covers our world. Because it says God spread the heavens out for us to live in, shows that this refers to our atmosphere that is perfectly created to sustain life on planet Earth. Job was a contemporary of Abraham and wrote, "He has inscribed a circle on the surface of the waters at the boundaries of light and darkness." Now, once again, Job knew that the earth was round thousands of years before Columbus. This verse also reveals that the atmosphere holds light only up to a certain altitude above the earth, where our atmosphere ceases as it follows the circle of the earth's surface. Amazing, isn't it? Who told that to Job over 4,000 years ago? In Job chapter 28, verse 25, it adds, "When he imparted weight to the wind." How could Job have known that air has weight? Science confirms that our air is about 50 miles thick and of exactly the right composition to support life. The elements in our atmosphere, like ozone, filter out deadly rays. If the earth were 10% larger or smaller, all life would die. Beneath the sun, we live in a fragile balance between frying and freezing. Early man thought Atlas was a huge turtle or an elephant that supported the earth. In the north sky, within the millions of stars, is a vast expanse of a blackness. Job 26, verse 7 says, "The earth is suspended on nothing." The Bible was written long before the telescope existed, so only God could describe this phenomenon. Today, we know that it's gravity that holds the planets and stars in their orbits, making them appear to be hung on nothing. By the way, how did the primordial ooze create gravity? Job 36, verses 27 through 28 explains the hydrological cycle. Condensation and hydrology maintain life. He describes the repeated cycle of precipitation, its evaporation, and condensation in the clouds. He says, "For he draws up the drops of water, they distill rain from the mist, which the clouds pour down. They drip upon man abundantly." Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 6, "Blowing toward the south, then turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along, and on its circular courses the wind returns. In ancient times, it was believed that wind moved in a straight line. It took modern science to document the direction of wind currents and wind paths. Who told this to Job and Solomon? Job chapter 38, verse 16 tells us, "There are springs in the sea." This was not widely known until 1913, when scientists discovered undersea rivers. So who told Job? Job chapter 38, verse 22 mentions the treasures of the snow. Each flake is of perfect dimensions, and yet all are different in design. The snow is beneficial for nitrogen for fertilizer. How often do you think it snowed in the southern Iraq, where Job most likely lived? Water is heavier than air, yet is transported in the clouds. Do you know about the layers of the thick clouds, the wonders of one perfect in knowledge? Job lived in the Middle East some 4,000 years ago. The book of Job, chronologically speaking, is the oldest book of the Bible. Yet, it says, "Out of whose womb came the ice, and the hoary frost of heaven, who hath engendered it? The waters are hid as with a stone, and the face of the deep is frozen." Who told Job about ice and snow? How did a guy living 4,000 years ago in the Middle East know about the permanent polar ice caps? "Hid as with a stone, and the face of the deep is frozen." What would a desert-bound nomad know about the deep in the first place? Job 38, verse 31 explains the solar system. The Hebrew speaks of a pivot or a hinge, which is the meaning of Pleiades. In the south-southwest is the Pleiades, which are the seven stars that make up the center of our solar system. Amos chapter 5, verse 8 says, "The Pleiades consist of seven stars." The seventh star was only discovered in the last century because the naked eye can only see six stars. The book of Job teaches a lot more than merely how to be patient and trust the Lord. It teaches that a man living in a tent in the middle of a great desert knew more about science 4,000 years ago than science knew at the dawn of the 20th century. Although Job told us in chapter 39 that light was in motion, it took the opinion of Albert Einstein before anybody believed it. As I mentioned, Job is the oldest book in the Bible, penned before Moses wrote Genesis, and set historically almost 1,000 years earlier than the Exodus from Egypt. Job didn't have access to large collections of books about natural science, geography, climatology, or physics. Neither did he have access to the writings of the prophets or the promises of the New Testament. Yet Job had never been taught about the rapture, the resurrection, or of a coming Redeemer in the last days. But he knew. Job confidently wrote, now listen to this, "As for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will take his stand on the earth. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes will see, and not another." Who told Job all of these things? The same one who told you. Our modern age is itself an age of miracles. We've unlocked the genome, duplicated life in a test tube, made a carbon copy of living creatures, and developed medicines with the potential to prolong life substantially. And scientists would say, we're just getting started. Science expects one day to be able to control the elements, bring rain to drought-stricken areas, anticipate natural disasters like earthquakes, and perhaps even prevent them. We can travel outside of our atmosphere, and one day we expect to reach distant stars. In the natural, it would seem that there's nothing we will not eventually be able to do. Science has pretty much been able to naturalize, internalize, and explain away what were, in previous generations, miracles, reducing them to probabilities, equations, charts, and graphs. With one exception, we can do everything except foretell the future accurately. The future contains too many variables to accurately predict it. In Daniel chapter 12, the prophet Daniel was given a vision of the future and of the world. He was stunned at what he saw and turned to the revealing angel and asked him, "When shall these things be?" He was told to seal up the words of the book until the time of the end, when many shall travel back and forth and knowledge will be increased. Now look at this. Until the beginning of the 20th century, very few commentaries existed on either Daniel or the book of Revelation. Both were considered to be filled with metaphors and symbolisms. Even John Calvin and Martin Luther passed up the challenge. The words were sealed until the time of the end. In this generation, the mysteries of Daniel and Revelation are largely unlocked. Columbus sailed to the New World 1,500 years after the Apostle Paul made his Mediterranean journey. Both sailed on wooden ships equipped with sails, as were ships until the end of the 19th century. 100 years later, the same trip takes a few hours by air. 1,900 years to get from Paul's ship to the Titanic. 60 years later, Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. We can certainly travel back and forth. Moore's law says that computer capacity doubles every 18 months. Knowledge is increasing at an exponential rate. There is technology being developed to make computers out of strands of DNA. Science is God's evidence. Bible prophecy is God's signature. They provide us with the proof of his existence and the assurance of our salvation. Peter's final message to the church before he was crucified upside down was his greatest message. He had just recalled those exciting moments in his life when he saw Jesus transfigured into the way he will appear when he returns. And he heard the voice of God, the Father, speak. Then Peter declares, "And so we have the prophetic word made more sure, to which you do well to pay attention as to a lamp shining in a dark place until the day dawns and the morning star arises in your heart." You see, Peter's last message is that the word of prophecy is even more sure than what he saw with his eyes and heard with his ears. So let him who has eyes see, and has ears, let him hear. The story of God's love for man is familiar in the Bible. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. You know, God gave the law of Moses for a purpose that very few people recognize. God gave the law of Moses to show us how good we would have to be in order to qualify for him to accept us. By man's efforts at being good and doing good works, he can never be good enough to be acceptable to a holy God. That's why God gave the law. And what is the standard you'd have to have in order to qualify by your own works? James chapter 2, verse 10 says, "Whosoever keeps the whole law, yet offends in one point, is guilty of all." Any takers? As I've said before, God's not going to grade on a curve. God is absolute. And that's why it says he sent Jesus to die in our place, to pay for every sin we'll ever commit, in order that he can be just. In other words, he won't compromise his righteousness and justice. In order that he can be just, and yet the justifier of the one who does no more than believe that Jesus died for him. You see, we can never be good enough, but he declares us as righteous as he is by giving us the righteousness of Christ. You can have that right now. Just say, thank you, Lord Jesus, for dying for me. I receive the gift of pardon that you died to give me. So right now, I receive his righteousness.